Welcome along and thank you for joining us. By request of our Patreons, we bring you a La Liga history special on Frank Rijkaard's Barcelona era. The Dutchman was coach from 2003 to 2008. There would have been little surprise if he'd been sacked halfway through his first season. But then Barca went on to become European champions. It was a thrilling time and a thrilling team. Terry Gibson is here. He moved to Spain in that period to work as a scout, and he came back towards the end to England to start working as a commentator for Sky Sports. So he had a close view of it all. But I'm delighted to say that we're joined, as you might be able to see, by a man who actually played for Barcelona under Rijkaard. Andrea Orlandi was with the Barca B squad that Champions League winning season. And he was called into the main squad at the end of that La Liga title winning campaign to play for Rijkaard's team. Terry, you start. Give us a quick overview. When we say Rijkaard's Barcelona, what does that conjure? What does that bring to mind?
It's a little bit unfair on him, actually. I think to everybody's mind, it conjures up a little bit of chaos. Maybe a lack of discipline is the reason why he left. And I think that's the overriding sort of impression people have. But we do forget what a fantastic team they were to watch during his period of time. The relative success he had as well. And when he took over the club, the team wasn't in a great shape. And I think perhaps at times, I think his work has gone unrecognised, to be honest. I mean, it's an interesting story during the prep, looking at how he got the job and looking how he got a number of his jobs, particularly as manager. I mean, we're talking about an incredible footballer, absolute world superstar at his best, with AC Milan and playing with Holland. But then his managerial career is somewhat strange. But we should appreciate and recognise the fantastic work he did during a period of his management at Barcelona. And they were great to watch. I remember watching young Messi, often on the bench in my first season, watching Spanish football live and, you know, linking up with Ronaldinho and players like that. Ronaldinho in particular. I remember watching them at Sevilla. And Messi, I think, was sub. And Ronaldinho was on the halfway line and Messi was on the 18-yard box and they're doing keepy-uppies with the volleys. So they were volleying it from the ball didn't touch the floor for about 10 minutes. And one of my lasting impressions is of the, and it kind of follows what we're talking about the chaos. Seeing them warm up before games, it was just when the team warm up was coming into play, which personally I hate. As a player, I preferred to do my own warm up. And I knew exactly what I needed to play a game. I would have hated to have been, you know, told what to do from the first minute of the warm-up. I was a slow warm-up merchant. I had to do lots of moving around and jogging before finishing, before the game starts with plenty, you know, some sprints, lots of stretching, stuff like that. And I remember some teams doing it, looking really organised with the cones out, stuff like that. And then I refer to Barcelona where Messi and Ronaldinho are playing keepy-up. He's 50 yards apart and the ball not touching the floor. And I remember a guy coming out in a suit and standing in the middle of the pitch, and they finished with sprints, you know, half a dozen, 10-yard, 12-yard sprints. But he was standing there in his suit, clapping his hands, and it kind of summed up the approach that I thought from the outside. We've got the benefit of having Andrea here, that, you know, he did coach by allowing these players to have a little bit of responsibility, whereas others at that time, it was all about putting the cones and the bibs out. And that was the first time we saw that warm-up. So I always remember looking at them. They were playing Malaga. Malaga were doing this super warm-up with millions of cones out and the guy in a tracksuit probably working harder than their players. And then Barcelona doing their own thing and then coming together just before the kick-off with the... This is not in the warm-up. They've gone in. When they come back out, the guy in the suit come out in the middle and made them do 3, 4, maybe 5 sprints. And then they would, you know, easily beat Malaga. So, but his work was... Some of his work at Barcelona and some of his football to watch was brilliant.
So, Andrea, it was an odd appointment, wasn't he? Because he was Dutchman. He hadn't played for Barcelona. His legendary playing career was elsewhere. As a rookie, total rookie, he'd been in charge of the Netherlands team that got to the semis of Euro 2000. Could say they bottled that game against Italy, didn't make it to the final. His only club experience was Sport of Rotterdam. They got relegated. He got sacked. So when he came in 2003, there's a new regime, isn't there? There's Joan Laporta and all of those young, wealthy Catalan guys have taken over the club. What was your reaction? What did everyone think when Rijkaard came?
Well, obviously, you know, the first reaction from everybody in Barcelona was, you know, they weren't really sure about what was going on. But he always had the protection of the Dutch connection between Barca and Holland. Obviously, the Cruyff era I started with was Linus Michels, Johan Cruyff, Neskens. There was a history of, you know, of success at the club with Dutch people. And what they needed at Barcelona, and this is what how I would sum up, you know, Rijkaard's era, is to bring a smile back to the club. And basically, there's a lot of negativity around Barcelona. Even when, you know, they were winning, they were never optimistic. You're winning 3-0, and you could hear people at the stadium, oh, if they score, it's going to be hard, you know, to win this game. So that was the mentality. And with Frank Rijkaard, very laid back, you know, very relaxed. And I think that the example of the warm-up says it all. This is the way that kind of actually, you know, got people to get in that flow, in that mood, and to bring some smiles back to the club. And, you know, by bringing some fantastic footballers to the team and allowing them and giving them enough responsibility to then go out there and deliver. You know, Johan Cruyff, he was all about, let's go out there and enjoy yourselves. And Rijkaard embodies that philosophy really, really well. Of course, it was an odd appointment. Of course, there was criticism. And at times, you didn't see it lasting long. But when I joined the club and I walked into that dressing room and I could see Rijkaard speaking to players and the way players were looking up to him, you know, because he had been a fantastic footballer. He had that aura, you know. And maybe it wasn't built to coach a small team. Mm-hmm. It was built and born to coach, you know, fantastic players in a team like Barcelona. So he had all the confidence, you know, his shoulders were big enough to cope with the pressure. And it was just, you know, his man management skills were second to none.
Fantastic. So that first season then, so he comes in 2003. There's a fascinating documentary about Laporta and how they really played on the Catalan image, the more than a club thing, and they sorted out the commercial side of the club as well. So there was a lot of revolutionising off the pitch going on as well. But they really struggled at first, didn't they? And they, you know, it wouldn't have been a massive surprise had he been sacked. And then they finished strongly at the end of that first season. So how much do we see his limitations as a coach in that first season, would you say, Andrea? But then they got better as the season went on, didn't they? And I guess by the end, there was that feeling of optimism.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he had to kind of, first of all, you know, land and see what Barca was all about. Of course, you know, I've said that he was a big player and he had enough confidence in what he was doing. But, you know, it took him you know, a little while to kind of settle in and know exactly how to, you know, which were the buttons that he had to press in order to make it work. There were a few signings that for me were important in January. You know, he brought on Edgar Davids, if I'm not wrong, and, you know, and players that kind of helped Barcelona, you know, evolve and get to the next level. You know, with Frank Rijkaard, the criticism around him was that, you know, it wasn't getting the best out of players like Xavi, for example, or, you know, it took a little bit longer, you know, for Iniesta to kind of explode under him. And, you know, but he gave them the chance, actually, and he made them better players. At the moment, people couldn't really see it. But with time, we did see the benefit of the work that Frank had done with them. And you know, it was, I think that he was the perfect man, you know, at the right time. And this is where I think actually, you know, the new era of Barcelona started. You know, when Laporta was a little bit patient with him, you know, he gave him the chance to make mistakes, to sort those mistakes out, and then, you know, start, you know, a new era of a very successful club where, you know, there were some dips and up and downs up until Guardiola arrived. But, you know, it all started with Frank.
So, Terry, there's a defining player of the, I would say, of the Rijkaard. If you say to me the Rijkaard era, one player springs to mind, who is Ronaldinho, who arrives in the same...
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. Who arrives in the same summer. So he arrives in 2003. He'd made the whole, his presidential bid around signing Beckham, and he gets... It almost, there's a little bit of luck in there, isn't there? As you know, a lot of success in football as an element of luck. They instead turn to Ronaldinho. We could do a whole podcast on Ronaldinho, but give us a short, because he basically lasts the Rijkaard era, doesn't he? And then he goes away, and in a way, he burned as bright and then burned out in that period. What a player though he was at his peak.
Yeah, I genuinely think. I mean, we they have this debate, don't we? Who's the best player of all time? I'm not even going to use that word that they used to call it. I hate it. But the best player of all time, so it's a boat rather than a goat. And it never gets mentioned. But I actually genuinely believe for about 3 years, he's as good as anyone that's ever played the game. That includes Messi. It includes all the others. But the difference is there was not the longevity, so the body of work isn't there that compares with Messi and Maradona maybe and others of that type. So, but for 3 years probably, it was a real joy to watch him play. I was in my 30s, 40s maybe, and getting there early to watch him warm up. It was an absolute joy to watch a player play. You never knew what he was going to do, but you knew he was going to do something special. His impression on Messi must have had a massive impression on Lionel Messi as well in the early stage. Imagine Messi being 17, 18 years old and you know, training alongside Ronaldinho and playing alongside him. That must have had an impression on him. But he was just a sensational footballer. I'm grateful for being out there and being able to watch him live on quite a regular basis. He was a superstar. I mean, a massive personality as well, happy-go-lucky personality. And, you know, he was brilliant to watch.
Terry, sorry, John. I couldn't agree more with you in terms of, you know, the pure talent and magic. You know, I was there and Messi was only 17, 18, turning into a big football superstar. But the talent that Ronaldinho had, I've never seen anything like it. You know, you can, when you train with someone and you see it, you know, every day doing what he used to do, it was just incredible. You know, I couldn't really believe I was there. You know, I had to pinch myself and think, no, I can't be a footballer. This guy is something else. The thing is, he wasn't consistent enough. You know, he didn't last long. Exactly what you said. But in terms of talent, he was more than Messi, believe me. You know, he was that magic, and he did have a big influence. And I always say this, you know, before training, he would call Messi, and he used to call him juvenil. Juvenil is like youth player. bring me the coffee, 2 sugars, please. You know, and he was. I was desperate for him to tell me to make the sugar for us to make the coffee for him. But you could see Messi standing up, very humble. You know, prepare the coffee, put the 2 sugars in, Ronnie, that's your coffee. But that was a way, you know, just keeping Messi humble, knowing that he was going to be up there. So he was one of theirs, but not yet. And obviously he did have a big influence in Messi and in everybody. And when I said that Rijkaard started a new era, you know, it was actually Ronnie and Ronaldinho who was the guy who brought the smiles back here and all the positivity. It was just, you know, a party to go out there, Camp Nou and watch Barca.
Isn't it funny that we used to like making tea and coffee for the older players? And like you, I'm privileged to be asked. My first room partner with Spurs was Glenn Hoddle. And Glenn was, to me, was like, you know, a god. You know, I was quite a bit younger than Glenn, but I was going to watch Spurs. That was my team. Glenn was the superstar. And I shared a room with him, my first away trip to Manchester. We were playing Man United and Man City. And I spent the whole time making tea for him and running around and tidying the bedroom up. And at the end of it, he said, I'll pay your room bill. It comes about 60 pence. And I was over the moon. I told all my friends I've been making tea for Glenn Hoddle 4 days. And he paid my room bill. And he said, how much was that? So, like, 60 pence. But it was weird how that influence of a player, you don't realise how much of an influence the older players have on the younger players in the group. So it was obvious to see Messi was influenced by Ronaldinho.
Can I take you to the summer of 2004? So a year in, the off-the-field regime have sorted the finances out a little bit. There's a bit more money coming in. And they move some players on. So Kluivert went, who I think was, according to, you know, the Final War documentary I've just watched, was taking a huge amount of the playing bill. Overmars, Luis Enrique retired. Saviola was loaned out. And in came, Deco came in that summer, Samuel Eto'o came in that summer, Ludovic Juli, Giuliano Belletti, who wasn't obviously necessarily a pivotal player, but he obviously played a huge part in to come. Henrik Larsson came on a free, having scored shed loads of goals for Celtic, and Silvinho. So was that reorganisation the crucial bit that put the team on the path to success?
Yeah, I think that you know, the players that you mentioned, one, you know, in particular for me, obviously Samuel Eto'o, that was someone that wanted to prove people wrong. You know, he had something inside. It was innate, but he had that, you know, that anger as well, you know, because he had to leave Real Madrid, and he always thought that he belonged to a club like Real Madrid or Barcelona. And, you know, in his first press conference when he was signed, he made it clear, you know, I'm just going to work my socks off and I'm going to be successful here. And he was. And Deco brought, you know, that winning mentality into that dressing room. Deco was serious, dead serious. It was, I mean, for me, it was frightening, you know, for a young player coming in and try to talk to him. I didn't dare. But it was so respected. The quality of that player, I mean, it was just unbelievable. And they were great as well. You know, he combined both things really, really well. He could run for fun, and then he could play as well. You know, he was a complete footballer. Ludovic Juli, you mentioned Messi being on the bench. He kept Messi on the bench for a long time. Juli was important, scored some important goals. So I think that, you know, those signings made a huge difference. A lot of quality, but obviously hungry players, you know, players that brought winning mentality to the club. Not only smiles, but we have to win. You know, we weren't winners. And that was the step that the club needed.
Mm. I rate Eto'o, Terry, well, it's not a thing to say. I rate him as an underrated player. But yeah. I think if you look at his numbers, you look at his trophies won. I sometimes think the weird thing is that we underrate him, perhaps, because Messi and Ronaldo then started putting down these ludicrous numbers of 50 goals a season and stuff. So in a sense, it eclipsed the fact that Eto'o had gone through his career banging in 30 goals a season at the top level.
And he was a brilliant... He wasn't just a goal scorer, was he? His work rate was fantastic, as Andrea alluded to there, that the winning mentality, his work rate was top class as well. Skillful player, he's mobile, wasn't he? Could, you know, play, obviously preferred down the middle, but drifted out wide, he had that pace to get in behind defenders. Great skill, obviously a brilliant finisher. Yeah, I agree with you. And another one of those players that's never on that list. Sometimes it can be a long list before you get to Samuel Eto'o and you think, oh no, he was brilliant player, not just for Barcelona, of course, but he was an outstanding player, outstanding striker.
So that was when the team took on the shape that I would say that was recognisably. I think if you asked someone to name the players from that era, you're talking these guys, aren't you? In the following summer, Van Bommel came, but Raquel May left, but he'd been loaned out already, hadn't he? And Rochenbach, just to reduce the wage, but actually made a profit in the second summer. And they won the La Liga title back-to-back. So at that point, how highly did you rate them at that point, Andrea, in those two La Liga campaigns, obviously culminated in the Champions League in 2006?
John, they were rock stars, honestly. You know, if you travel with the team, the amount of following, obviously Ronaldinho had his own security. Samuel Eto'o had, you know, people around him. It was just, you know, we were like the Beatles. They were. And it was just unbelievable, the quality of training. You could see that everyone was getting the best out of each other. If you think about Samuel Eto'o and his work rate, he felt he was a little bit less than Ronaldinho, but he didn't want to. And he just worked so hard in order to get to those numbers because he had that inside of him, you know. He just wanted to prove he was the best. And it was just incredible. I mean... you know, the quality, the confidence as well. You know, you didn't feel you were going to lose a game. And I've said that before. They were preparing for a Clásico, and I had the privilege to train with them for a week. And John, it rained for 2 days in Barcelona, and there was this really tiny lightning bolt. We just heard the noise. And after the circles, before training, 30-minute circles, Ronaldinho went, coach to Frank Rijkaard, went, this is dangerous. Huh? We should walk in. And that was on a Wednesday. So they trained for 30 minutes, just passing the ball around. Same story on Thursday. And then they trained on the Friday. They won 3-0 at the Bernabeu on Saturday. So it's just, they were that good, you know, that they didn't need to be coached. And Rijkaard was perfect for it, you know, because he knew exactly what the team needed at that time. And I think that, you know, it was just unbelievable. I think you mentioned Van Bommel. Van Bommel didn't make a huge difference in that team. He should have started the Champions League final, if I'm not wrong, against Arsenal. And he did play, you know, a few important games that it was difficult for him to settle in. I think that the important signings were, you know, the previous ones. But what a team. I mean, what a team. It was just, it was unreal.
Was there
a... Sorry, can I just say about that narrative about Deco? Is that we all... over the years is that he's been included in Ronaldinho's gang, which was ill-disciplined towards the end of Rijkaard's regime. But hearing Andreas speak there about how disciplined he was and how determined and that winning mentality, that comes across slightly different to what we've... the story that's been told, you know, when Pep come in and players he wanted to move out and stuff like that.
I wouldn't say he was the perfect pro. You know, I wouldn't put him like the perfect pro, but he was just... he had the perfect personality. So for him, in order to perform on the pitch, maybe, you know, it's not on, you know, not on the guidelines that Pep has, you know, where you have to eat, sleep and train, you know, like the way Pep thinks. So maybe that wasn't Deco's mentality. But at that time, he was perfect for Barca. He was the player that Barca needed. And I also think that it was the right thing to get rid of him at one stage, you know. So... you know, it was those 2 or 3 years where Barca got the best out of him. And then it was time to change. But it was crucial, Terry, because everyone looked up to him. You know, even Xavi, Iniesta, you could see that he was, you know, very respected because he was a quality player. He was fantastic.
How strong? Tell us a bit about the tactics, Andrea, of this team. Because we look back now nostalgically at the superstar attacking players. The run to the Champions League final of 2006, they win away in Chelsea 2-1, then they draw at home 1-1. Quarterfinals, 0-0 away to Benfica, win 2-0 at home. In Milan, they win 1-0 away and then draw 0-0 at home. So this is not frivolous. This is not silly football, is it? They knew how to win a game.
No, absolutely. And obviously, they were stubborn at times. You know, there were moments where they had to, you know, defend, dig deep, and they did, you know, because they had the players. Remember that, you know, with Rijkaard, they used to be always, you know, a proper holding midfielder. And at times, it was a central defender, you know, that was used in that position. So, you know, it wasn't strange to see Edmilson playing there sometimes, Rafa Márquez. So it wasn't like, you know, the Iniestas, Xavis, they were playing every single game. You know, it wasn't the case. So they knew what they had to do. You know, tactically, it was pretty simple. You know, basically, it was just give the ball to the good ones and they'll make the difference. And that was it. You know, it was Barca style. Yes, 4-3-3. Yes, we'll play. You know, we play the ball from the back. This has always been Barca. But give it to Ronaldinho as quick as possible. You know, and when I played for the first team, I was used as a fullback. And my only job was just don't lose the ball and just give it to the players that had to make the difference. And this is how they won the Champions League. Mm-hmm. You know, Ronaldinho, we didn't really see him in the final, but this is when Larsson came on and made the difference. And Belletti scored the winning goal, you know, and other players, you know, shown. But that Champions League was all about, you know, getting the right results. And that AC Milan was a very strong team. And the goal was scored by Ludovic Juli, you know, in the first leg away at San Siro. So there were difficult games. You know, it wasn't like Barca were overplaying teams or outplaying teams. It was just about, you know, when you had to scrap a result, they knew how to do it, and they did.
And that's only the second time they'd won it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we got used to them winning it again now, haven't we? Not perhaps in the last few years, but a period of time where that was kind of overlooked as well, that was only their second time ever. And we all recognise and, you know, those of us old enough to remember the importance. And we're still constantly told it does come up from time to time. The first time Barcelona won it, but the kind of second one gets sort of moved away before we get to Pep and Luis Enrique.
Yeah, but the first one was in 1992. Yeah. And then they had to wait up until 2006 to win the second one. And that's when I talk about that negativity around the club and... You know, and was the important thing was installing that winning mentality back. And this is what they needed, you know, some profiles of players that they had at the time.
And in the final, Terry, they played Arsenal, who were, it was probably the end of Arsenal's great, that great Wenger era. Wenger stayed around a long time afterwards. But it was an exciting, it was a cracking game. Have you watched it back recently? I
haven't. No, seen the highlights.
Yes. So some weird things happen on the edit. Right, I'm criticizing people's editing skills here. On the Barcelona YouTube channel, on the edit, they don't show the red card.
Is what? So they've tried to pretend they beat 11 after, was it 18 minutes or something, wasn't
yeah,
it?
It just looks like they've substituted the goalkeeper. Because you see Almunia coming on and Lehmann walking off. But you think, well, hang on, you've got to, surely the bit where he gets sent off is absolutely crucial to the game. And I tell you what, looking back as well, the referee is an absolute stinker over that, doesn't he? Because Lehmann comes out, brings down Eto, who's going through on goal. The ball runs to Julie, who rolls it into the back of the net. Yeah. 1 second later, and he blows his whistle and sends off the goalkeeper. And you think it was a goal? Just let them have the goal. Yeah. It was extraordinary, wasn't it? And then Arsenal, obviously, they don't score from the free kick. Arsenal take the lead, and then then Barca had to launch a comeback. I mean, it was a thrilling game.
Yeah, and Iniesta comes off the bench as well. And I think the other substitutions he made had a big impact on the game as well. So it was, yeah. And I remember looking at him yesterday and talking to people, and it wasn't just one person. It was two or three different people, scouts, Spanish scouts of other clubs that I've got to know, and agents. And they said, it's a secret. Iniesta's the best player. It's the best Spanish player, but nobody knows it yet. It hasn't been revealed to all, but trust me, this Iniesta is going to be the best ever player Spain have ever had. And I remember thinking
Iniesta,
at the time,
Iniesta is my age, yeah. 1984. So I played against him at the youth ranks. And from the first minute, you could see he was going to be a superstar. Unbelievable.
And that he came in at half-time, so he wasn't starting yet, was he?
No, he wasn't.
Trying to break into the team. I remember when I was with Northern Ireland and we beat Spain, Iniesta wasn't a regular in the team then until Northern Ireland beat them, and Aragon has got rid of all the other players and the Real and people like that, and brought in all the new ones. And Iniesta, I think, was sub that night against Northern Ireland. And it was, so he was quite a late developer, wasn't he, Iniesta, in that? And Rijkaard obviously took a while to make him a starter. But and you add that to the names that we've already talked about, as you said, Xavi and Iniesta, that was the beginning of them. We kind of think Pep introduced those, but it was you know, Rijkaard in particular, Iniesta.
What do you remember, yep, Andrea, about the 2006 final?
Well, obviously the tension, you know, building up to it, where, as I said before, it had been a long time without winning it. And it was kind of, they had to, you know, it was their moment. And people probably thought that it was going to last longer, you know, than what it lasted eventually, you know, with Ronaldinho, Deco, this type of player. So that was the chance for them to nick it and win it. And I think they had the team to do it. They had a better team against a fantastic Arsenal. And even with 10 men, Arsenal, through Thierry Henry, there were moments where Victor Valdés had to, you know, had to cope with it and save Barcelona. But, you know, it was very tense. I said earlier that, you know, there were lots of smiles and, you know, it was very casual sometimes preparing for big games, but it wasn't the case for the Champions League final. And you could see the tension released, you know, after that win, the celebrations that probably we went into the game where I made my debut and players were still, you know, I'm not going to say drunk, but they were still celebrating the Champions League win. That was what, you know, made Barca. You talked earlier about more than a club. You know, they were saying it already, but that was the moment where, yeah, now we are where we want to be and when we want to be, you know, winners, and we are at that level. So, you know, it was a special moment, and you could sense that the club was desperate for it, and it was hugely, hugely needed and hugely important.
Mm. Would Messi have started that final, Andrea, if he'd been fit?
No. He didn't play, and he didn't celebrate with the team after. He just walked into the dressing room, but he had that that level of ambition, Terry, where he knew he was that good and he felt he had to play. But Rijkaard, you know, he used Julie in front of him lots of times, and obviously he had to earn, you know, the right to play. And the same with Iniesta and Xavi. Well, Xavi played more than Iniesta, but Iniesta, as you said, you know, it was like he burst into the scene and then started playing every single game. So he had to grind and work hard in order to get his chance. And Messi wouldn't have played, no.
And then if we move on from that, the 2006-07 season, again, Terry, we could do a whole podcast on that season, because that is an incredible title race. Because we're not yet at the stage where these two teams, they move into a phase where they start getting 90 and pushing 100 points. But 06-07, they got 76 points each. And it was decided on head-to-head with some incredible games at the end of the season. Real Madrid got a 4-3 against Espanyol. Walter Pandiani scored a hat-trick and they had to come from behind. And then there's a famous game where Barcelona mess up. They drop points against Espanyol because Raul Tamudo scores in the I think it's the 90th minute of the game.
He's my neighbor, John. I see him every day.
Oh, really?
Raul Tamudo. I see him every day walking down the street. El Tamudazo. What a moment that was.
Yeah.
So he was a great player as well, wasn't he? Yeah, Tamudo for Espanyol. Really good striker.
But it was a brilliant campaign, that, wasn't it? It was thrilling times. So now I was watching it back earlier, and I was quite nostalgic for it, actually, because obviously it was Valencia who beat Barca to the title in the first Rijkaard season. So those two teams weren't quite as dominant as they were to become, but it was a brilliant peer and a brilliant rivalry.
We've become so many people think it's just always been about Real Madrid and Barcelona, but they've had to work really hard some seasons to keep up the pace. And often when one's won it, the other one might have been third, fourth, fifth. So it's not always been dominated. More often than not, of course, it is. We have to be realistic. But there are, you know, some of those games between, as you mentioned, some of those other players, Tamudo and Pandiani. What was Pandiani's nickname? He had a nickname, didn't he?
El Rifle, the Rifle.
The Rifle, that's it. Yeah, the Rifle, El Rifle.
He used to drive a truck. He was a truck driver. He drive around with a truck. It was unbelievable.
But before he was...
No, he used to drive to the training ground with a truck, not a car. Yeah. Unbelievable. Just go on YouTube, you'll see it. With a big rifle on the track as well.
Was it? Brilliant, excellent, brilliant.
And so they don't win the league in 2007 because they lose out on head-to-head. And then 2007-08, they actually end up finishing third that season. And that's despite they sign Henry, they sign Yaya Toure. So you'd think, you know, on paper, and obviously Messi is now fully emerging to be the Messi that, towards the Messi that we know he went on to become. So this is the big question about Rijkaard, isn't it, Andre? What was the limit? Why did it come to an end? Why did they have that really disappointing season?
Because I think that, you know, once they won, John and Terry, it was different. You know, even in the 2006-07 season, even though it went down to the wire, you could see that, you know, there wasn't the same attitude and the same anger too. And they weren't, you know, as humble as they used to anymore. So basically they thought they'd be better than anyone else just by being what they were, the same training regime. And Rijkaard was excellent, but he gave players too much responsibility, and then players had to, you know, then deliver. And it wasn't happening. And obviously we all know, you know, the situation with players like Ronaldinho, where even physically you could start, you know, you could sense that he wasn't the same footballer. And even though he wanted to react and wanted to train harder, he wasn't getting the same, you know, the same results on the pitch. So it was, I think, I wouldn't say the players let Rijkaard down, but probably, you know, Rijkaard was not going to change. You know, that was his strength as a coach. And, you know, I just give you everything, guys. You know, I'm like a father figure for you, but then it's about use. And if you don't feel it, if you don't have that fire anymore, this is when you need to change and change, you know, faces and bring new players in and eventually change the coach. I think that, you know, the 2007-08 season was a difficult and a painful one. And I remember I joined Swansea at the time, and after the season ended, I just went and see practice at the stadium at the Camp Nou and talk to some players and to Frank Rijkaard, and you could see it was just too much for them. You know, they just felt that, you know, it was the end of something and they needed something different, and Rijkaard wasn't the right man at the time to take things forward, and it's a shame. Fantastic coach, great man, fantastic man. And I'm sure if you ask players now that, you know, they played under Rijkaard, they will tell you that he was very important, hugely important in the club's development and history. But it was just, you could see that he kind of lost the dressing room.
So Terry, a different personality, didn't it, to drive them on again?
And if you think,
or clear them out,
he did 5 years, didn't he? Which now,
yeah,
you look at,
I know,
at
it was longer than I thought, actually.
Yeah, and not many coaches do 5 years. Especially that style of manager where he's not really a man to rebuild a squad, which he obviously needed.
To crack the whip on a regular basis, maybe not every day, but, you know, as Andreas said, it's important to have the right type of personality. You need an overhaul. If you're a manager who's quite laid back and you know, quite relaxed about everything, it's difficult for him to come in. And having built relationships over that 5 year period, then you do get close, you know, players do get close to managers, managers get close to players, you form a relationship that can sometimes you can carry on for the rest of your life. And then for Frank Rijkaard to change personality and get rid of players, it would have been difficult for him to do personally. But during the prep for this, looking at, I was surprised how long he was there, you know, and you see the story about how he nearly lost his job in the first half of the first season. And then the success and the pleasure we had watching them, and then a couple of seasons at the end of it where they don't win anything. And then the story continues with Pep coming in and the whole thing changing again. And it kind of eradicates the fantastic work that Rijkaard did. And we have to talk about him as a player as well. I mean, he was an incredible footballer. He was, him and Hullet and played against them for England under 15s, for England under 18s. We were in a tournament, and it used to be called the Little World Cup. It was the European Championships. And we shared a corridor in the hotel for 3 weeks in East Germany. And they were on one side of the corridor, we were on the other side. So Holland had one side, we were on the other. And we used to sit, because there was no television, there was no phones. It was East Europe back in its prime. So for 3 weeks, apart from playing games and training every evening, we'd sit, and Hullet and Rijkaard had the big ghetto blaster. So we'd all sit in the corridor, speaking English and talking to them opposite, in sitting, you know, sitting outside your hotel room in the corridor, and they were giants. I mean, it was a whole new thing to us because they were big, and you know, they both had the big hair. They were both larger than life personalities, and they could play every single position on the pitch. You know, in that tournament, they played centre back, midfield, centre forward, all the way down the middle. They could put Hullet on or Rijkaard out on the wing. And they stood out then as two incredible footballers. And for Rijkaard and both of them to be together at AC Milan and to achieve what they achieved there, along with Van Basten as well. He was an absolutely brilliant footballer. His career is marred by the spitting incident on Rudi Völler, you know, because people do remember him for that. They remember him for Barcelona, from losing the discipline of the players towards the end of his campaign. But we should really genuinely remember the star quality he had as a player. And as a coach, particularly at Barcelona. You said he didn't do a bad job for the Netherlands. That was his first job. He'd been an assistant. His first job as a rookie is to be the national manager, which is kind of ridiculous. Then Sparta Rotterdam, second division, get relegated to the second division. Kind of ridiculous then that he gets the Barcelona job. I agree totally with what Andreas said about it. He wasn't built to coach players like me. He was built to coach Eto and Ronaldinho and Messi. And that is how he, you know, he got his success. But having that style quality as a player does help you when you take over a team like Barcelona, and the players there respect you immediately. But then you have to deliver as a coach, and he obviously did for a few years. So he's a huge personality in the world of football and Barcelona.
So then the club goes in a different direction, Andrea. And how important was the decision, not only that did they sack right or move Rijkaard on? But Ronaldinho and Deco went at the same time. How important was that in giving Pep what he needed to bring a whole new style and a whole new era in?
Yeah, obviously, and Pep wanted to get rid of Samuel Eto'o as well, and he couldn't do it. And Eto'o was really instrumental, you know, in that first season for Pep Guardiola. Probably nobody knows, or not too many people knows what happened in the last Frank Rijkaard year of Barcelona. He, on Thursdays, we used to do games between ourselves, the Barça B team and the first team. I wasn't there anymore, but he let Pep Guardiola take training, you know, for a big part of that season. Not because he didn't want to train, but because he knew that Guardiola wanted it badly, okay? And obviously, he wasn't going to stop, you know, because this is Rijkaard. This is how good he is, honestly. Generally, as a person. So this is when they knew that Guardiola was prepared. But that was a brave appointment again, you know, from Joan Laporta, because he was unproven Guardiola at the highest level. He just coached Barça B in the fourth tier of Spanish football. Anyway, you know that Guardiola could sense, and because he's that intelligent, that there were a few problems. And in order to refresh the team, he had to get rid of the big, big stars. You know, starting with Ronnie, Deco, and he wanted Samuel Eto'o out as well. Why? Because they had a big influence in a certain Leo Messi, and he knew that, you know, the rebuild of that team, you know, the team was going to build around Leo. So we're going to have Leo as the big star, and in order to have Leo at that level, we need to get rid of all of the others. And this is what they did. It was brave. It was difficult. You know, they were very, very important characters in the dressing room, not only players, but it takes bravery, you know, to be at, you know, at that level and to be a leader in a club like Barca. Pep Guardiola was and is, and Joan Laporta was and still is. So, you know, those were brave decisions, but the right ones to make at the time.
Yeah, and essentially, well, so after that, Rijkaard coached Galatasaray, which wasn't really a success. He went to Saudi Arabia, and wasn't really a success. So when we look back at his managerial career, it was incredibly successful, but relatively short. He's not a manager. He hasn't got 1,000. He's never going to manage 1,000 games, is he? I guess he wasn't built for that.
No, he's just the guy. That's him. He doesn't need it anymore. He doesn't feel like he wants to be a coach anymore. He's had loads of offers, loads and loads of offers from big clubs. And he just turned them down because he didn't feel, that he wanted that. You know, he felt at the time that Barca was the perfect place for him, and he was, and he did a great job. Then Galatasaray, Saudi Arabia was an odd one, but that's him. This is how he felt. And right now he's just, you know, focused on different stuff and not football. I wouldn't be very, very surprised if we see Rijkaard going back to management one day. And maybe... Yeah, we'll see him coaching Sparta Rotterdam, because this is what it makes him feel, complete as a person. That wouldn't surprise me. But this is why he's a special guy. You know, he was a father for so many players. You know, I've seen him hugging players when they needed to. If he had to go to your house and talk to you, he would. So that he was that type of manager. Very different, very rare. To find in football, a real person, a real guy.
Sorry, bizarre noise is off. Sorry. So, Terry, you give us some concluding thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with Andrea. It's an interesting managerial career. I've just about what a superb footballer he was. And for periods of his life, when he was manager of Barcelona, I think, we should remember the good stuff that came with it, you know, and it is, as I say, it's kind of overshadowed by the last couple of years when they didn't win anything, but we forget the magic that we saw from underneath him and the part he plays in, as Andrea quite rightly said, and I didn't know about this, but he was the him and Laporta were the difference. They started this cycle that we've seen in the last 20 years, and it started with Frank Rijkaard. Before that, they were having their problems. But then along come Frank Rijkaard, Laporta, and then Pep, and then, you know, the rest we know. from then on, but he's hugely important to Barcelona Football Club.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. It's been fascinating talking to you, and it's been good to reminisce. It's always good to just say the names of old footballers, isn't it, and think of old games and old seasons. And there were some great times there. So, Andreas, thank you very much for your time and for your memories as well. And Terry, thank you very much, and we'll see you for another podcast soon. And everybody listening, thank you for your support, and Patreons, thank you as well.